Today, I want to begin by reading you a story. And I think it's important to note that it's a true story. It's written by one of our previous and one of today's podcast guests. Our quail eggs have hatched, and getting these could have been at the cost of my husband's life. We had to pick them up from a rural area, which was closer to his work, so it made sense for him to pick them up after work. I kept questioning myself. Is it safe for him to do this? Maybe I should take the time to do this. Well, he was thinking the same thing and called me before leaving, asking me to please inform these farmers that he is black. So I did. The eggs were going to be out on their porch, and he felt incredibly uncomfortable going up on their porch to collect them. Once he got to the area, he called me confused about not knowing which house was theirs and stressed about the situation this put him in. He did not want to walk up onto the wrong porch and have someone come out and confront him, call the cops, or worse, get a gun involved. I tried to calm him down and reread the directions to the house and told him, "It will be fine. They know you're coming." However, inside, I was truly just as scared as he was, unsure what might unfold, and wondering, will something happen that I will never be able to forgive myself for? Silly, right? It's just quail eggs. And he rightly said, "Yeah, they know, but the neighbors don't know that I'm coming." He asked me to try and connect with the farmers one more time. So I tried, but had no response. So I told my husband that the house you're describing to me sounds like the house the farmers described. "I think you need to trust and just knock if you don't find the quail eggs on the porch. And call me as soon as you get them, or if anything happens." Ugh, this is ridiculously stressful stuff. Well, he called me and said he got the eggs. All was fine and he was headed home. Phew, we both sighed a large breath of relief. Silly? But not silly. This is reality. Birdwatching, going for a jog, sitting in your home has shown us that these simple things get black people killed. Killed. Not one more breath of life. Gone. Totally gone. These are the day-to-day little things that we're always taking extra cautions around just to live as a black person. But is it enough? I want to tell my beautiful children holding their chirping baby quail that it is enough, because it would tear my heart to shreds to experience it not being enough. I still can't bring myself to telling their sweet souls that potential reality. This needs to change. Change needs to happen. It's long overdue, like 400 years overdue. Please speak up, allow yourself to get vulnerable, and have humility to try and understand our own biases and try to get it right. That's what the world needs right now. That's what black and brown people need right now. The author and experiencer of that story was Shannon May, and her husband Charles Fai are both guests on the podcast today.
I always say, if you had a choice to have the Vikings play a Super Bowl in their stadium or in the stadium of their opponents, which one would you choose? Most people would be like, "Damn right, I want it in that stadium." Why? Gives us home advantage. So think of the fact that as a white person, you have home advantage over a black person all day long. And it's always great to honor those advantages, not to feel ashamed of it, but to recognize it and be mindful when you are dealing with a person next to you that they don't necessarily have the advantages you have.
Hey, this is Judy with Wellness Renaissance and the Wellness Renaissance podcast. I am really appreciative to be able to share this conversation with you. This is a two-part episode, and they are both packed with just amazing and appreciated perspectives that help us make sense of things and figure out how do we go forward. This conversation was both had and is being released pretty close to 2 weeks after George Floyd was murdered by a police officer in Minneapolis. And there has not only been a lot going on in the streets of Minnesota, other states in the U.S., and other parts of the world as well. And it doesn't take but a minute to scroll through your Facebook feed to let you know that people are trying to understand, process, and figure all of this out. So I am grateful for Charles and Shannon to take their time and to be a part of that conversation a little more fully than a Facebook post can do. I want to thank you so much for listening to the podcast, and I just appreciate all of you who share the podcast, whether it's through Facebook or sharing your emails. Sharing the conversations and the episodes is the way that the podcast grows, and it's the way that the people who are on the podcast get their information out there. So I thank you so much for doing that. It is a beautiful way to support the podcast. And of course, thank you so much to all of you who are Patreon supporters. Thank you for being a part of the Wellness Renaissance community and being a financial supporter. It is huge, and it means so much to me and the work we're doing, and it helps keep this ship afloat, and it means so much to me. And if that is something that you would like to do and be a part of and support, you can go to the wellnessrenpodcast.com page and look for the Become a Patron button, and that will take you right to Patreon, where you can join and support the podcast. It is very easy. And I want to thank our advertising sponsor, Green Home Solutions, the indoor air quality experts. If you're needing support around disinfection, also mold, odor, allergen control, check them out. You can find them at greenhomesolutions.com. You can connect up with Steve Stern here in Duluth. And if you are one of our listeners across the country, that website will help you find the closest person to you. If you have a minute to check out the show notes, one of the things that we talked about is the training that he's doing here with the Duluth Police Department about implicit bias. And PBS has a segment called Intersections, and they did a couple really great segments with him and the training and how that all came about. So check that out. All right, let's join Charles Fai and Shannon May. First of all, I want to welcome you guys. Thank you so much for taking your time and having a chat with me today, because we have a very busy world right now. And
right.
And I think we need both conversations, and we need people to share with us their experiences. And that's exactly what I want you guys to do. So I'm just going to start off by letting you both introduce yourselves.
Great. I am Shannon May. I have lived in Minnesota for most of my life. I was actually born in Minneapolis, but we soon moved up out of the cities, and my parents built a home on a lake in the woods and grew up around the Walker Hackensack area and went to school there. And I was always when I wanted to explore the world. So between my 11th and 12th grade in high school, I spent most of a summer as a Lions Club exchange student to Chile. And that was just kind of such an eye-opening experience in terms of being like, oh my gosh, there is so much to learn about the world. And it's so exciting and so fascinating. And what if every kid, you know, when they graduated from high school, had to either do some type of volunteering in their community or go do some supportive component out in the world to just be in a different culture, be in a different place, and just get another perspective of things than where they grew up. And did AmeriCorps after that, and then did Peace Corps. And that's where I landed in Cameroon.
Ah.
And that's where I met my now husband, Charles. And so I will let Charles take it from there.
Well, I'm Charles Fai, of course, born and raised primarily in Cameroon, West Africa, where I met my lovely wife, and we eventually immigrated here to the States. I've lived in, what, three cities here, Minneapolis.
Yeah, Portland. When we came back, we initially lived in Minneapolis for a year.
Portland, Oregon.
I moved out to Portland.
7 years.
Where we did our postgraduate work.
Yeah. Oh, nice.
And now in Duluth, Minnesota. I train now, and I work as a mental health therapist through DHS. I do run a small private practice in town, and I specialize mostly in my private practice, working with teenagers, that suffer from a variety of, you know, coming to see me from a variety of issues. And I do take pride in my spare time to find pleasure in coaching. So I am at the very least, I'm a soccer enthusiast. We call it football enthusiast. So I do coach soccer a lot in the community, and that's my spare time. And in my other spare time, I had devoted myself in kind of working with the Duluth Police Department, one, in understanding mental health and developing skills to deal with mentally ill people, and two, in the area of bias, kind of addressing implicit bias in community policing. So I have also invested my time in doing that and doing those trainings and working with consulting with the police department in that
capacity.
Yes.
That's so interesting, the training that you're doing. And just, I'm thinking, my gosh, we could all as a society use some of that training. I mean, police deal with situations much differently, but I think that the conversation is probably well had by all of us.
Yes. And I think, like you say, I do believe every business that deals with people need an elaborate form of training in bias. And I have faced a lot of that in businesses around too. Sometimes I think the hardest for me has been in businesses rather than policing, because I kind of expect it from police. Mm. It hits me by surprise when I do get, you know, treated differently, clearly differently, just because of the color of my skin, rather than anything else. I think it is more impactful for me when it comes from businesses, because I at least expect that. But it happens more often than I care for. So yeah, and that's been my passion. And you're right, I am exploring ways of bringing this to the community and just really having a broader conversation with the community, business by business, about you know, implicit bias and how they play a role in how we relate to, you know, with people of color and just minority in general. And so I think it's another avenue where we'll need to explore to just expand that, building that awareness of things that we might not be aware of, but really very impactful on how we deal with and how we view and address and deal with minority people of color, Black people, mm-hmm. and specifically Black males.
So it's an interesting conversation. I think, Shannon, just, you know, that the thing that you mentioned of after school, if there was an opportunity for people to go and visit another culture, I think it's so huge. I lived in India for 6 months in 2007, and, you know, it was so interesting when I told people what I was doing, the responses that I got. You know, some people are like, oh my gosh, it's so great. And other people are like, oh my gosh, why in the world would you want to go there? You know?
Right.
I just had was listening to a conversation a week or so ago, somebody who had said, you know, I realized they were somebody that, you know, wasn't a young person. They were saying, I realized that I have spent most of my life where I have never been in a situation where I am the only person or one of the very few people who aren't white in a room.
Right.
And I think that's a very interesting thing when we're not in environments where, I mean, it's not easy to do in Duluth, let alone Minnesota, in some ways, depending on what you do and what situations and experiences you put yourself in. It takes an effort, I think.
Right.
Absolutely.
So people don't, you know, they don't get that opportunity. To give you just a perspective of how I come to this conversation and from a lot of different perspectives, I mean, I think just the community, obviously, with everything that's kind of happening and bubbling up with so much awareness that we have. And it's freaky to me to watch my Facebook page and see so many different perspectives. And I like want to have a conversation with so many people to help me understand how they came to the perspective they came from. I just saw something the other day saying, you know, white privilege is a completely made up thing. And there is no such thing. And I sat there going, oh my gosh, I want to have a conversation with you. Cause that's just not my experience at all. And I also come at this from the perspective of, and at the same time, completely recognize that my experience is very different than yours, Charles. But I grew up with a visual disability, which my growing up years, I had Coke bottle glasses. So it was very obvious to people.
Sure.
Absolutely.
You know, where now I had surgery in my early 20s to try to get away from that. I was hoping I would end up with better vision. I didn't. But so much of it for me was to find a way to pass. I just wanted to look more normal, quote unquote.
Sure.
And I recognize that there is a privilege in that opportunity, right? Like you, Charles, you can't, you know, you wake up black every day. Mm-hmm. You know, there's nothing, you can't hide from it. So I recognize that it's a totally different experience. And at the same time, I also kind of want to like have more of those conversations where we can bridge those experiences to help us understand each other and know that our differences are, you know, that our experiences are really different, but at the same time, there are threads of connecting.
Absolutely. There is. The things that I tell people is, you know, we are more alike than we're different.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But only if we can hear each other, only if we can give an opportunity to listen to each other, we would realize how much we are more similar than we are different in so many different ways.
Right.
But something as easy, as simple as, like you say, having a vision disability, mm-hmm. being black, completely all of a sudden sets you apart from the rest of the people.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden you become treated differently just because of your disability, which is not, you know, and only if we can build that awareness. I know initially you had talked about white privilege. I have, and I, you know, when I talk about this, I really always want to tell people how I start my day. First thing I get up in the morning, it's every day I pray to myself that I come back home alive, which is, we all hope that we would, you know, but this is something that a lot of people take for granted.
Mm-hmm.
But to me, getting out there, every single day I open my door and I walk out, I kind of switch from a home mode to I am now out in the world. And the truth is, as a black male, I believe I have to bring 100 and 150% of me, the best part of me, out in the world. Otherwise, the consequences are huge.
Mm-hmm.
But that's always in the back of my head. Like, I can't have a bad day without serious repercussions or serious consequences. And so that's the first thing I do when I get out of bed, is I have that prayer, I have that mantra out that today I will put forth my best foot forward and I will be mindful. And ultimately that I look at my wife and my children, I say, I'm going to do everything I can in my power to come back home alive. But that is my life. That is my daily life. But someone that is not, you know, a white person do not have to think of their safety in the same level in which I think of my safety.
Mm-hmm.
Even when I do my job, I have to put in 150% because there's always doubt.
Mm-hmm.
Into your qualifications. There's always doubt into your ability to do things. And most importantly, because I do things very differently from, you know, the culture, the majority culture. So once there is that difference, once there is a shift from the norm, it is not considered value. It's not considered an asset, all of a sudden it becomes a liability. And so it's really very, you know, for people being open to those diverse ideas, it takes a lot of shift. It takes a lot of awareness. And like I say in my video, it's the hardest thing for people to think about, to see themselves as hurting other people, because as I've always said, in their core, they're just doing it right. They are not that person. And so, like you said, it's harder to have those conversations because people do not believe that they're hurting, that what they're doing hurts, and that what they're doing just, you know, puts any other person at a disadvantage. So when there is that heart, there's that core belief that of self-righteousness, whatever you want to call it, it takes that conversation to a whole different level. Instead of saying, tell me about the experience. Tell me how I can improve your experience at work. Tell me how I can improve your experience in my neighborhood. You know, it is more about we are doing things differently from how it's done, and it's not looked upon as a positive thing. It becomes looked upon as a negative thing. And then you really have to switch who you are and just be mindful of, you know, kind of put part of who you are aside as you walk into a workplace, as you walk into a business, as you walk into, even when you are in a situation that is in a charged situation, an emotional charged situation, you always have to be mindful to put sometimes who you are as a person aside and kind of put forward a behavior that is more norm to the community in which you live.
You're in a sense accommodating for everybody else. You know, you're accommodating to fit in so that everybody else feels comfortable.
Absolutely, yes. And I'll give you an example. Naturally, as a Black male, as the West African male, we are pretty loud people. We speak very loud. And being loud, it's more seen as aggressive here. Like, for example, when I'm complaining at a store, this is my day. If I'm frustrated about something in the store and I'm complaining, I always hear, sir, you need to walk out. Sir, you need to calm down. And I'm like, I'm not upset. I'm just passionate about what I'm saying. sir, okay, we'll get the security if you don't leave. And that's just, you know, like you can get angry as a Black person because it's instantly a threat, you know. So I have to accommodate that, deep breath, bring my voice down and kind of speak. But I could hear a white person going completely bonkers when they're mad, and it's okay. And so this is that constant accommodation. Instantly you're seen as this angry Black person. And what is the stereotype of an angry Black person? We better get a cop here because it's gonna get ugly soon. People like this effect. And that's the part, they know that's that side that I'm talking about. And it just makes it harder.
And for me, what I feel was really helpful, once again, going back to cross-cultural experiences, is that, you know, when I was living in Cameroon, it's like some of the kids I'd see on these roads to the farms, like they'd never seen a white person, and they would literally see me and scream, crying, tripping over themselves, bloodying their knees, trying to run away from me, thinking I was like, they didn't know what I was, you know, a ghost or whatever. And just like crying and like running to someone they knew. Cause like, what is this thing walking down the road, you know? And it was like, I was embarrassed and I felt bad, and I love kids. So I was like, what? No. And it was really interesting. And so I stuck out in the community like a sore thumb, right? And like some days I wouldn't want to come out just because I was just tired of that. Mm-hmm. And so it really gave me this internal experience to really see, like, and here I'm a white person in Africa. You're looked up upon and really put on a pedestal. Mm-hmm. But even with this around, it's like, wow. So what is it like for a minority,
right,
in the United States to be sticking out like a sore thumb and everyone reacting, but in such a negative, you're not put on a pedestal. Mm-hmm. I'll tell you that.
Right. Like,
you know, at least I had that advantage in Cameroon. But it was exhausting. Some days I just wanted to stay indoors and not make someone cry and not make someone run away from me and not, you know, it's just like, I didn't have it in me today.
Wow. Yeah.
You know, it really gave me that perspective of one. It's like, yes, like at our innate DNA level of survival, there is a piece of us that we're just trying to survive. And anything that's unknown to us, we want to have some level of fear, right? And it, but it can't get irrational. And acknowledging and creating that awareness of around being real with ourselves of when is that irrational? And what are we doing to try to create commonality and to learn and understand so that it's not unknown anymore and we have a better sense of what we're dealing with?
Right. We don't get trained in this culture to sort of have the anthropological, well, that's interesting. What do I make of that?
Right, yes. Right,
you know,
right.
It's good or bad or, oh my gosh, you know, and I know from my experience in India, I don't know how many people were necessarily running away from me, but boy, I tell you, I was very aware that everybody was paying attention to everything I did, right?
Right.
And I didn't know, we had one person that was there who had a friend who was Indian who spoke Hindi. But she was very light skinned. So everybody thought she couldn't speak. So the things she did hear, the comments about that she heard was very interesting.
Well, everyone was watching you, right? And you didn't necessarily know what they were saying, but.
Right. Well, right. Exactly. And it was that awareness of, I would go to one of the malls I would go to. I had one coffee shop that I didn't go there for a little while because I found I found a different coffee shop that had better lighting for me to sit and read. And I went back one day and they're like, you haven't been here for so many weeks and you didn't, like, oh my gosh, you know. And then I was in the other coffee shop and I was there for quite a while in the afternoon and I knew I was going to be there because we had a driver when I was there. So they had a particular time to come pick me up. And I was sitting here going, oh, it's going to start to get dark soon. I wonder if there's lights in here that I'll be able to read in another, you know, hour and a half. And I looked up, all I did was glance up. And 5 seconds later, the lights all went on. And it's just that awareness. Again, India also putting, you know, white people on pedestals. I didn't have, for the most part, I didn't have the fear. Like, it sounds like, Shannon, you had a lot of that every day. Most of the places that I was when I was there was not the experience. A few of them, I knew it was like, okay, this is, I know that I'm not, you people are not comfortable with me here. So talk a little bit about your experience living as a family with kids here in Duluth.
Yeah. I feel like so many people can have the capacity to love a baby and a little tot and little ones more than an adult or a teenager. And so, you know, we have three kids. They're still little. My oldest son is 10, so he's starting to get in that tween age. So what is that? That's really now where I'm starting to think about, you know, they've been cute little kids running around and everyone's okay with them, it seems, you know, but how does that shift as he becomes more independent on his own and, or, you know, coming into adolescence? How will he be looked at? And he'll be going to middle school next year and it's going to be a big shift from his elementary school and just curious to see how that goes. So when they're with me or with us as a family, I don't think really experienced anything per se.
Okay.
But I'm concerned and I worry about it all the time as he gets older. It's like, you know, with kids, you wear your heart out in the world through them. And it's almost just so much more palpable in a way to know that, oof, I can't, you know, helicopter him as much and be around him as he gets older. And so what does that put him up against? And I can't be there to be that mama bear.
Right.
So that's the challenges I'm going through and trying to recognize that. And just also, how do we approach that? I feel like everyone has a different way of, how do we address this with our kids? How much do we tell them? You know, I think for the most part, generally, we've really tried to give them a really blissful childhood and a happy upbringing. And it's so hard to, like, you know, say like, okay, we're going to have to start to crush that a little bit to make them aware so they don't get into these situations that could potentiate and increase their risk of something terrible. And that's the hard reality of it, you know. And not because every parent has to do that for certain things, but because I have to do that because of the color of his skin. And that's what gets me and is just so heartbreaking because to them, they're like, what? Like, that doesn't make any sense. You know? And I'm like, yep, I know. And so that's where I think the challenges are more ahead, that we're trying to figure out, and how do we approach this and save their childhood and yet make them aware yet. And
that's a big balance. Like
it
you said.
Is, it yeah. really is. And it's something we're always trying to juggle with every day.
Cause you don't want to put so much fear into them that they
right.
operate in the world almost like out of fear, which then causes other people to sort of feel or perceive that. And then assume that something's going on when there's nothing going on. They're just trying to be conscientious of their environment.
Right. Exactly.
Wow. So are you, with just all that has been happening around Duluth and Minneapolis and the world, are you having conversations about this, or is this something you've been able to kind of go, okay, we don't have to deal with that yet?
We've been pretty, with this, with George Floyd that just happened, we've been really open with our 10-year-old.
Okay. About
it. He's been listening to NPR with us and car rides, like he's just, you know, it's like, what? That's just crazy. Like, how do people not see that? But that's crazy. Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, we are being conscientious of having the kids live a normal kid life. We've made it very clear, this is not your fight to fight. And it is okay, you know, to be a child and really try kind of foster them to be the best child they can possibly be. And just, you know, assure them that we are fighting for it and we are doing the best we can to ensure that they have a better life as adults when they grow. Really instilling that hope that, yes, we'll keep fighting for things to improve and your life is not all doom and gloom. You know, just to, like I say, reduce that anxiety and rest assured that the community, their community and Duluth community as a whole, it's pushing for changes, including my work with the police is part of that, bringing that awareness and helping so that they can have a better Duluth to live in if they choose to live in this community or generally nationwide, a better country to live in.
And I think we philosophically have always really been open with them about, you know, well, I'm a naturopathic doctor and a Chinese medicine practitioner. And so straight from Chinese medicine, the philosophy of yin and yang, you know, there is that duality in everything. And until you look more holistically at everything, everyone and everything, you don't have the best big picture. And so through my vocation, you know, that we're using in the house every day and through the philosophy of how that works with us and our bodies and nature and the forest around us, it's all part of us. And within the doom and gloom, there's also so much beauty, and that duality exists all the time, no matter what. And so it's important to recognize both. And I think that also gives them a bit of groundedness and a stepping stone to work in the world in that light.
Yeah. And I always continue to say, there are in some incredibly beautiful, really thoughtful people around here and curious people, you know, people that, you know, want to understand. Even before the Mr. Floyd's death and, you know, the ensuing protests and all that stuff, I do feel and believe that I've met lots of incredibly supportive people in Duluth. Mm-hmm. And it's always important to put that out there. I believe we have, as a family, we have a lot of support here. We have a core group of friends and lots of people that are genuinely wanting to build that awareness and wanting to build that, you know, that inclusive culture. And so it's not all doom and gloom. We do have support. We have built a lot of support in, you know, in the community. So that's something to celebrate.
Right. You know, I would say two weeks since George Floyd's death, but honestly, even before that with COVID-19, there's been a lot of these conversations are similar, but different. And, you know, there are a lot of people who are, they're trying honestly to figure out and make sense of everything. I mean, I think you guys can speak to this if you want to, because I think it's such a huge thing. I think there's a lot of confusion around how do we perceive, how do we feel? And I think there's a lot of options and there isn't a right way, but just some of the things that have come up, you know, of the whole, you know, some of the people saying, oh my gosh, I can't believe people are blocking the road. You know, how horrible is that, that people are on the road? And then other people are like, oh my gosh, I totally understand why they're blocking the road, but my gosh, I'm fearing for their lives. It's a dangerous thing to do. And other people who are like, you know, you're inconveniencing me. And it's like, well, but they've been inconvenienced for how long? And every day. And like you say, Charles, every day you get up and go out of the house, right? So it's kind of like, well, I'm really sorry that you couldn't get your milk as quickly as you wanted to. And I know that's not the case. There are people that are in a hurry for important reasons on the road. And I'm not trying to diminish that either. But I do think the statement is an important one to at least try to take in, even if you're in a sense annoyed with the people on the road. I think it's an important thing to understand what the underlying message is from that. And you can speak to that, you know, as well as just the confusion of what we're seeing in with neighborhoods going down and people, you know, how much of it is from people coming from outside and hurting that location because they have no vested interest? How much of it is the anger that's just there?
So there is a little bit of everything in it. It's not one. It's a very complex thing. It's not one. But what I would say is, as a human being, violence is not my thing. If that were my choice, how to deal with it, violence would not be where I go. You know, peaceful protest. But then for me, it's not just the protest. It's what do I do after the protest is gone? Mm-hmm. Because the protest might raise an awareness for something. But there's lots more work to do than just a protest. Because a protest is, we've done this so many times of my short stay in Minnesota. And then we protest, and then we riot, and then the next we put our placards away. And the next day we are taking them out and erasing the names and adding, you know, it was Fernando Castillo, now it's, you know, George Floyd. And so to that I say, it is, the violence is, whatever is happening, protests, violence, looting, is a reflection of our community's complete failure to address the underlying cause. And to the people who feel inconvenienced, I would say, let's focus. Let's not let the violence and the looting and what is happening derail us from addressing the core of why we got here in the first place. Mm-hmm. And that is creating an equitable society, and that is dealing with systematic racism, and that is reforming law enforcement that is really over policing people of color. And I really shy away from saying black communities, because it is another way that that a white person could completely disengage and distance themselves from what is going on. When you refer to, you know, people say, yeah, in black communities, I said, we live in the same town. This is our community. And for people to start taking on that ownership and not distancing themselves, because if it is their community, I don't have to deal with this. They deal with it. Mm-hmm. It is the same town. We live in the same town. So it is our community. And just kind of taking that wholesome ownership of the town so that we can together work on changing this. Because to be frank, this is not going to change without the support of the white residents in almost about any town. If we are going to, you know, kind of really change this from a structural point of view. And so their community, they won't change it because they don't have the power. Now, who's got the legislative power? Who've got the power to change this? Who is in a position where they could start enacting those changes? It's not the minority. It's the majority culture. And so it just hurts when I hear people say their community instead of our community, because in a way, I'm not responsible for changing it. They are. Mm-hmm. It's their problem. Look at how they are doing. No, it is our problem. It is our city. And unless we start to speak of it, taking ownership of that, it will continue to be a black or white problem, which should just be the Duluth problem, which should just be the Minneapolis problem, which should just be the national problem. So I think it's another way where we can start to make those changes and to make by taking ownership. of what's happening in our town, in our communities.
Right. It's interesting because I think of like you're saying, it's, you know, yeah, if you say it's the Black communities, it's so easy to other and put that in a box and not have to think about it, which doesn't mm-hmm. work for anybody. Mm-hmm. Yeah, when we think about the whole together and being, like you said, our town, I think we have been sort of sold this idea of self-advocacy, mm-hmm. which is a thing, and it is good to be a self-advocate. However, I think it's a much bigger thing than that. And you don't, you know, no movement has ever, as far as my education has gone, no movement has ever happened without people outside that movement giving that movement support and credence and saying, you know, this is how this is going to happen.
Right.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, I from a person with a disability, I see that as a, you know, people can say, well, you need to self-advocate. Yep, I can self-advocate all day long. But if a person looking at me goes, you have no value because you are this person with a disability, there's nothing I can do to change their mind. Because like you say, Charles, you got to work 150% sometimes to earn somebody's, you know, shred of respect to get them mm-hmm. over a hump. So mm-hmm. There's no way we can take this and put it on somebody else. And I think it's what's killing me when I'm hearing people say, you know, white privilege isn't a thing, because I'm like, oh my gosh, I don't, how can we even work with that? And maybe that's not where one puts the work. But I want to ask you, I want to throw a couple words your way. Mm-hmm. Privilege being one of them, because I know this is a word that is it so many people feel it's overused and it's tired and people stop listening. Mm-hmm. And I think that's an unfortunate thing. And there's some great memes and examples and videos about what privilege is. And I was looking up the word and the definition of the word privilege. And I think this is interesting. It says one of the definitions is a special right, advantage, or immunity granted or available only to a particular person or group. Now, I understand that white people, they look at that and go, well, I wasn't given anything. This isn't granted. This is just how the world works, right? But then here is the example they use in this definition. Education is a right, not a privilege. And I'm thinking of how, okay, we think of rights as something that people get, but boy, when we talk about education, how much privilege do we see in where you're educated, what school you go to, you know, all of that. Like if they see their kids in a school district, their white kids in a school district that doesn't get the best teachers, that doesn't get, you know, whatever the situation might be, and say, well, those kids have it so much better. There's an example. That's at least one thing to maybe attach to. But I just thought that was really interesting. And so I wanted your opinion about the word, because I don't like to use the word because I feel like it stops people from listening, but I don't know how else to express it.
You know, we like sports in Minnesota, right? Mm-hmm. Talk about the Vikings. I always say, if you had a choice to have the Vikings play a Super Bowl in their stadium or in the stadium of their opponents, which one would you choose? Most people would be like, downright, I want it in our stadium. Why? Gives us home advantage. Mm-hmm. So think of the fact that as a white person, you have home advantage over a Black person all day long. You live in a community with people that look like you, speak like you, understand you, even before you speak. That's home advantage, and that is privilege. And so I love to use sports as, especially with, you know, you're wearing a Vikings fan, it's and a Vikings or a whatever sports you, hockey, whatever sports you follow, I use it as a way to explain. You have an advantage over somebody, some way, shape, or form. And that advantage has been generations upon generations upon generations upon generations. Education is a right. Tell that to a Black person. It doesn't seem like a right mm-hmm. because most Black people don't even have a single person in their family that graduated from college. How right is that? Tell me what right there is in that. Mm-hmm. So if I don't have anybody graduating from, who's ever graduated from college, I don't see it as a right. It's a massive privilege because it's a mountain. It's climbing Mount Everest. It's just one of those things that a kid teenager doesn't even see themselves as ever capable of doing it, even before they get a chance to. So that's an advantage, and that is privilege. Advantage is privilege. And so I tend to use the word advantage. And I always say, you know, as a black male, I am privileged. I am educated. It's privilege. Mm-hmm. I get, when I speak, people believe I'm informed, so they are more likely to listen to me. It's privilege. I can afford to live in whatever neighborhood I want to live in, you know, and that's privilege. You know, I have a job. That's privilege. Mm-hmm. And so we do, at certain levels, do have some advantages over other people. And it's always great to honor those advantages, not to feel ashamed of it, but to recognize it and be mindful when you are dealing with a person next to you that they don't necessarily have the advantages you have or the privilege you have. Most people don't want to hear that word. But to know that right off the bat, that you have an advantage over that person, in just because of the color of your skin. We talk about wealth. As a white person, you have been building wealth in your, you know, for generations upon generations because you had that advantage. Most black families have not even had the privilege of homeownership. Mm-hmm. And so the ability to build wealth. And so that means they have to work a lot harder to earn credit. They have to work a lot harder to get a bank loan. They have to work a lot harder, but you don't as a white person, because ultimately this, you know, you've been building this wealth as a race, or as, you know, for generations upon generations upon generations. And that advantage is privilege, and it's important to own it. And it's important to be aware when you are, you know, dealing with a person of color, that you have that advantage over them. Even if you work the same job and you make the same money, your dollars would go a lot further than their dollars, just given the fact that you live in a majority white community, and a community where systematically has been built to favor their own. And that's survival. We all, as a human beings, have natural instincts to favor our own kind. And when you have power, you are not thinking of Charles when you are making policy. You know, you're not thinking of the Fies, you're thinking of the Johnsons when you're making policies. Mm-hmm. as a white person, because that's what makes sense to you. Those are the people that actually elected you there. So a lot of your policies are geared towards satisfying your constituent that might have 5% black people and 95% white, or whatever you want to call it, you know, or 70% minority and 95%, 75% or 30% minority and 70%. And so when you are in there, most of the time, that's what you're thinking about. Who are you most likely to hear from as a policymaker? From the white person whose voice they believe is a right. And so where would your policy be geared towards? The people that are loud. And like we say, the squeaky wheel gets the oil. And so, and that is, at the very basics, the foundation of structural racism. And we don't see that. I'm just serving my constituent. Yeah, but you have focused on the 80% of your constituent, and the other 20% is not being looked at.
Right.
And it is very clear. We talk about the schools. Who gets the biggest funding? Is it the school that is most likely going to be attended by black people and other poorer people? No. The schools that are most likely going to be attended by white people, by white kids. Mm-hmm. And so here is the advantage they already have. And so who gets to go to Ivy League colleges? Whose certificate is most valued, depending on what school you come out of? And all those are advantages and they're privilege. And so it's important to, you know, for people to realize that you have a home field advantage.
Right.
And just be aware that the people who do not look like you are disadvantaged.
And I would say and add to that, as Charles is saying, you know, this idea, you know, as human beings that we are, you know, taking care of our own per se, as human beings, that also when we're living in community, that only gets us so far. You know, it's so important that we have to raise that consciousness to the community? And how does that ameliorate the community and just not your own? Because what happens is the rioting and looting. And then, you know, and you can only strangle people. And this has been through the world over and over. There is a, you know, basically a civil war going on in Cameroon since 2017. And it's from the same fact, like you can only strangle people so much before they start to fight back.
Right.
And that's when you need to create awareness, be like, whoa, where did this get derailed? We need to look at the why. We need the holistic approach to this. We need to look at not just treating the symptoms, but treat the illness. Mm-hmm. Else this is where you end up.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. In some ways, when things started to go down, it was kind of like not totally surprising, you know? Right. I mean, it's kind of like, well, how much can you push somebody and eventually they blow, you know?
Absolutely. And it happened out the world over and over and over again. This is not a new concept.
Right. Right. Yeah. If you're a white person, we say you go postal. So.
Right.
And, you know, and when you hit the point of what do we got to lose? You know, I mean, one of the things I do is I work with the domestic abuse intervention program, facilitating groups of men who have been arrested for domestic violence and hearing mm-hmm. some of their stories. You know, they occasionally will talk about situations, especially the guys of color who are like, yeah, I had no idea if I was going to make it out alive. I had nothing to lose in this situation. You know, this is going on. This is going on. What do I got to lose? I might as well give it my all in one way or another. And sometimes that's not always a great way, but I can hear where they're coming from, right? It's like you can, they can look back at that now and go, okay, that probably wasn't my wisest decision, but can completely understand where it came from. And I think that's, it's kind of like, look, this is a powder keg. When do you think it's at some point it's going to blow?
Also, you can choose not to agree with the looting and rioting. But in that same judgment of not agreeing, it's important to also then hold space and time and give value to asking yourself the why.
And this has happened. This is not new. I wasn't surprised that we will spend more time focusing on the looting and the violence than the actual thing that happened, mm-hmm. you know, and get a lot more vocal people. Some people focus on more of the looting and the rioting than the actual thing, because we've been here over and over and over again. And so the media has been very good at spinning that into continuously reinforcing the fact that black people are uncivilized and dangerous, and you know, because here we go again. Here they are destroying our properties, looting our stores, just continue to paint that picture that continues to reinforce that thought process that black people are
wild and uncontrollable. Wild and uncontrollable.
Right.
And so when you have that in your head, it becomes that anxiety and that fear that drives your interaction with a black person, mm-hmm. to the point where people's anxiety and fear about black people reinforces how their interactions with black people, and actually weaponizing that fear. You know, I'm going to call the police on you. I'm going to call a cop on you if you don't stop. I'm not going to ride in the elevator with you because you are in there. And these are things that I really notice as a black male, even here in town. I'm going to cross the road and walk on the other side because you're coming up towards me. You know, the cop that when I each time I pass looks at me and locks eye with me and says nothing but just to tell me I'm seeing you. I know you are there. And just that fear, and I think it's time for us to squash that fear and focus on what's going on. How do we change that?
Yeah, because that's my question. How do we change that?
Like I said, it's one, it's taking ownership of our community. It's not their community. It's not our community. It's not my, you know, my white community. It's not their black community. It's our community. And what happens in our community ultimately should affect us, you know, We should feel that ownership of what's happening in our community. We should be able to step up and hold our community members accountable for their behaviors, and not let the person of color, the minority, be the ones that are voicing. And so what I would say is, instead of being a sympathizer, I've told my stories to a lot of people, you know, and I have a book of them. And people will shed a tear. And I'm always like, I sincerely do not shed a tear. What I want for you to do is to become an ally. I cannot tell this story alone. I need you to pass my story along. I need you to become an ally instead of a sympathizer, because that's what our community do. Poor George. And then we go about our business until the next thing happens. And if you were to ask me what to do, is we need to be all involved, become allies, and at the very minimum, hold our leadership accountable to make change, to enact changes, you know, and invest in getting to know. I always say, when invest in getting to know a Black person, if you have a Black coworker, invest in getting to know them and getting to understand their lives, you know, become an ally in a way that you are not a sympathizer, because sympathy doesn't help. Being an ally, sympathy helps in the moment, and sympathy is all about your own emotions and how you feel about the other person. But when that comes and goes, life goes back to normal. No, instead of being a voice just for your needs, also be a voice for the voiceless. And how that is to a person is all different. You know, it's all different. We can all do it at different levels, given our comfort, what we're comfortable with.
Expand that comfort zone as well?
Yes, and expand that comfort zone as well. I always say, if you are a business owner and your employees do not replicate the percentage of your community, you are not being an ally. Mm. You know, how do you attract, employ, and retain people of color? How does can our police force also reflect the demographic of our city? I think we have, if I'm not mistaken, one or two Black police officers in Duluth.
Oh, wow.
And I say, let's look at our jails. If you can find enough Black people to put in jail, you can find enough Black people to employ. Mm-hmm. You know, and so being an ally is really offering those opportunities. What is the leadership of your organization? Mm-hmm. Does it reflect the demographic, of your community? If not, then it is time to find a way to attract and retain people of color. Because ultimately, diversity is a massive asset and not a liability. And also offer people of color an opportunity to be heard.
Right.
Because most of the time, we are not heard, you know, or we don't feel like we have a voice. Mm-hmm. And most of the time when we feel like we have a voice, we are protesting. That's when we... And so how do you continuously start finding a way of taking the things that interfere with us having people of color in the leadership of our town? Mm-hmm. And I don't mean having a person of color in a diversity role, because we have skill beyond just diversity.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. And also, you know, most of the time, and I speak for myself, it's left upon me to educate my friends, my co-workers, the people around me. You know, can you try self-education and ask informed questions instead of just staying in your place and staying in your comfort zone and expecting me to educate you? So when you make an effort, learn a thing or two, and ask informed questions, show investment, you know, and it's all in those tiny little changes. And like I say, the changes will not happen until we start to change ourselves, until we start to build our own awareness, because it is in that we become allies, that we can stand you know, hand to hand and demand for changes. We can stand together and fight for systemic changes. Beyond that, we will all put our placards away and go home and go back to our normal lifestyle.
Yeah. And that's one of the conversations that I've been having with people, you know, about the world right now. It's like, I don't want it to go back to normal. How do we keep this conversation going? It's just exactly what you're answering right now. We don't want it to go back to normal because it's exhausting to have that happen too. From when you do want to see a genuine change. And one of my groups, one of my men's groups one day, I had an absolute, it was so fantastic. So it was me, my co-facilitator. Normally my men's groups are co-facilitated by a male and a female. To this particular day, it was just me. And every single one of the people in this one particular group happened to be people of color. And we ended up having this fantastic conversation about when they first experienced racism. When did they realize they were different, you know? And it was a conversation. I sat there going, I want the world to hear this.
Absolutely.
Because it's like, this is the conversation I want to bring everybody in on, because it was such a great, it was such a cool conversation. And it was so fascinating to me to get to hear and hear them be vulnerable and hear their stories, that I'm like, this stinks, because they go out in the world and they can't do this. They can't have this conversation with many other people because people aren't always interested. Or, and I know sometimes it truly, people haven't quite thought about how do you ask, you know, how do you start a conversation and be respectful? And I think that that's, you know, that's a challenge too. And I think that's something that we can, especially if we are, have a coworker, right? Like, you can start to find the commonalities of discussion eventually.
Yeah. Eventually. You know? It is. And people have to make a conscious choice to be invested.
Right.
And not be complacent, or not stay in their comfort zone. And that investment will make changes. I have been so, I have watched the protest and seen how diverse it is, you know, from different towns. And I said, I think this is the time. This is the time that we, it's another level from the civil rights. And I think this period will forever be known as the second tier of civil rights. And I just hope that anyone listening, to keep that momentum, because this is not going to change with a stroke of a pen. We've run the risk of sliding back to that, to what came from. And I, you know, I say this because sincerely, I am afraid that I could be the next Floyd. That is a fear that is in my mind a lot. You know, I, not once, at least in two occasions, I have had police guns pointed at me for reasons that they should not be. And I always come out and I said, I survived those two. What if the next time becomes when the trigger gets pulled?
Thank you so much for listening. We're going to take this conversation farther and deeper next week. We get in some of the details of the stories of his experiences of being pulled over or being questioned about getting in his own car or being held at gunpoint. We also talk a little bit about some of the concepts around equality and equity and the concept of being colorblind and a lot more. So please join us next week. Thank you so much for listening. And until then, may you continue to find the pieces that fit into your health and wellness puzzle. Take good care.